You are listening to Jaya Ashmore. You can find hundreds of meditations and talks on my websites, jayaashmore.org, jayaashmore.org, as well as opendharma.org, opendharma.org. All the recordings are offered in the tradition of generosity or dana, and your gifts are welcome. Thank you for listening. Are there any questions or anything to share?
I have a very practical question. I sit in a chair due to knees and weak lower back. And it feels like the more I lay down, the weaker the lower back is. Like I can even sit straight in the dining room. So I was wondering, is that just the selfish for not letting just to rest? Mm. Or how prepared to actually take some care for the physical body?
Yeah. Do you do any yoga or anything like that?
Yeah, in the mornings. Daily, I do.
Yeah. And do you have things that are good for your back and knees? And so maybe I can, after this, look at how you're lying down when you lie down. Yeah. I wouldn't want to go into interpretation and assuming it's self-sabotage, or it can be something physical, it can be, so we take care of that body. And find the positions that are good for you. Yeah. Anything else? Feels like the wind can do the Dharma talk today, no?
I've been loving watching the monkeys, and I know we have to beware of them, etc., but I just keep loving this, like, playfulness in their bounding and movement, and every time I see them playfully moving, it just fills me with the same spirit, and maybe projecting playfulness into them, that's working for me, too.
What was the very last
I may be projecting playfulness onto them, but that's working for me too.
Yeah. I love when they just, the huge body just through the air all the way to the ground or to the next branch or whatever. There was a Zen master named Ikkyu. Who also called himself Crazy Cloud sometimes. Ikkyu means having once paused. Having once paused? Is that, the English is fine? And he was the son of the emperor, but not the son of the queen, not the son of the empress. And so he was sent away before he was born with his mother to live in the low part of the city. So I think maybe literally low, but certainly. And when he had his sort of second enlightenment experience, the poem that he wrote, it feels like something of the feeling of today, that wind. He did some of his training with a really, really strict teacher, and it's that story that almost sounds like it couldn't be true, sounds like a fairy tale, where he goes to the gate of the monastery to ask to be a student, and he's kept outside the gate for 5 days, and the teacher even has other students pour buckets of water on his head. But eventually he gets to come in and study with this teacher, and one day he was just out on the lake there. And he just heard a crow. And something like we practiced this morning, the experiencing sound as a meeting, as nothing more than a meeting, or being met. And the utter delight and groundlessness of that acknowledgement that our experience is just being met, meeting. Gautam Buddha talked about it as the English translations are never very poetic. Co-arising. That it had to be that things came together for there to be anything. Without this, not that, without that, not this. So the hearing and the sound, the meeting. And the utter fulfillment of letting there be meeting without anything more, no ground. So Gautam heard someone talking about my enlightenment, my peace, that I am at peace and I am enlightened. And he said, this I is clinging. So I am at peace is when that little bit that we keep thinking that we are, that one leg that we have. How kind of cute that whenever anything happens, we think, oh, it must be mine. It must be my problem, it must be my peace. I must have done it. And we suffer. for that. Even in the peace, when it's I am at peace, we suffer it, even in the peace. Because we've blocked ourselves from the fulfillment of the meeting. So here's one translation of Ikkyu's enlightenment poem. Ten dumb years, I wanted things to be different. Furious, proud, I still feel it. One summer midnight in my little boat on Lake Biwa. Kawee! Father, when I was a boy, you left us. Now, I forgive you. I just love that he puts that last line on there. No one does that. It's so uncool. The Zen enlightenment poem is just the boat at midnight on the lake mm-hmm. and the crow, the end. But just the feeling of that kind of healing that something in us is scrounging for. Like trying to find any little scrap. Because something did happen and it did suck. It did hurt. And how easily the hurt makes us crawl into that little sense of self that then seems to take everything as mine. My path, my enlightenment, my pain. And so it could be interesting, these questions about decision making, and do we make decisions or not? Do we have intentions or not? And who decides which intention comes up into the mind at which moment? Thinking back to the poem yesterday, the rise of rain, the shift of wind, I won't get it all, I didn't have it here, but the drop, the red drop, is it, of a star on a far water rim. Shouts, laughter, silent contemplations, an endless catalog. Coming together, that co-arising, without this, not that. In the poem, all of that made you, made me, made us. From day to day, like it's a continual making. Not that little me that partly is questionable because it does seem to stay stuck on the same tune the whole time. Whereas really, something keeps getting made from day to day, keeps getting met from day to day for joy. Child. Ten dumb years, I wanted things to be different, furious, proud, I still feel it. One summer midnight, in my little boat, on Lake Biwa. Ka-wee! Father, when I was a boy, you left us. Now I forgive you.
What's the ka-wee?
The crow. I didn't bother to do a real crow sound. Ka-wee! They don't really say ka-wee anyway, they say ka. At least maybe on Lake Biwa they say ka-wee. He just heard a crow sound. So furious, proud, from in the hurt, we're trying to get to healing. But from in the hurt, we don't. And it doesn't mean that forgiveness is impossible. Forgiveness, healing, another way of living. So this question about decision making, depending on where the question comes from, sometimes the small sort of thing, the smallness, wants to basically know, am I in charge or not? And how in charge am I? And what can we say? What could we say to that? That would be like talking to Ikkyu in his 10 dumb years, furious and proud, about forgiving his father or something. But if we can hear in the question of the smallness saying, am I deciding anything or not? And the fear in that question, am I not deciding anything? Am I deciding everything? How will I know? In a way, the question leaves a big gap that we can kind of fall into. About what is the I that would be deciding or not deciding? And then I think we can really get going in our path. Mostly by finding out how much we're just running like a machine on our programming. Ten dumb years, I wanted things to be different, furious, proud, I still feel it. And even though it's hard and humbling to come across that again and again, how much programming there is. Isn't it a relief also to come in contact with some honesty? Ikkyu ended up staying with that teacher right through to the end of that teacher's life. He went to that teacher to describe his experience with the crow sound on the lake. And the teacher was like, yeah, well, you're just an arahat, which means you're just a bit enlightened. You're not like really enlightened. You're not big time enlightened. So he said, you're just an arahat, you're not a master. Like, yeah, that's good. But you're not a master. And Ikkyu said, oh, I detest masters. Detest is like a hate. I hate masters. And of course, it's almost obvious what the Zen teacher will say. Oh, then you are a master. Now you're a master. So just feeling when we want to get something out of anything, including our practice, what happens? And if we play with trying less hard and finding more continuity that way. Then there's less danger of trying to be like a master. Then detesting a master, we are one. We're not trying to match the idea. So if that trying to get something seems to be what mostly turns on our programming, turns on all the machine, the mechanical reactions, where then we are so predictable that anyone could, you don't have to be psychic to know what's going to happen next. Someone smiles at you and you're happy. Someone looks weird at you, you feel weird. There's a pleasant meditation, you feel happy, proud. There's a difficult one. And so in one way, the fact that it is predictable, and in a way, if we're willing to hear it, it's really obvious that it's just hurt happening, it's just hurt in action. It's just hurt taking it personally. It was a difficult day yesterday. What's wrong with me, or what's wrong with this place, or what's wrong with Jaya, or what's wrong with my neighbor, or what's wrong with something? The path, life, God. And it does go that far, very fast, in 1 second. We feel hurt, and then all of a sudden, the preciousness of life is in question. And so, at least, it's pretty obvious and childish. We can kind of pick up on it, the tone, the direction, the extreme. And the fact that we can kind of hear or feel that is a good sign that there is a chance. For maybe some other kind of decision making or happening. And I think it's also pretty obvious really early on that it's really hard to escape the programming. The hurt and all that comes around the hurt is really easy to get pulled into as a motivating force. But maybe we also have some kind of moments with a kind of some kind of smell of unprogrammed. Unprogrammed coming together, unprogrammed meeting. Sometimes in a moment, just the eye and the sunshine on a leaf, that meeting. And it's a quality of stillness and being moved. Delight and kind of coldness. And less than a second later, we want something from it and the programming is on. And so the tips from Gautam about noticing how quickly seeing or hearing or tasting or smelling or touching something, how almost instantaneously we're gone most of the time. And how lovely and different it is when we don't rush out to the sense door. We just stay with that open. So in Buddhism, they talk about guarding the sense doors. I think we could put it maybe also in other ways. Someone one time asked my teacher, Papaji, about what to do. He was having this feeling of really not liking people and wanting to just close the door and keep them out. And Papaji, and the guy asked, what should I do? Something doesn't sound quite right here. I want to just keep them out. And Papaji said, in his typical, also kind of Punjabi Zen master style, take the door off the hinges. Get rid of the door. So with the sense doors, hearing, seeing, smelling, tasting, touching, sometimes we might want to guard them, and sometimes we might want to guard their openness. Keeping them open might be what guards the preciousness of life. Guards a space for that, the intimacy, the meeting. That is delight, that is quiet. And sometimes the openness has a bit more momentum and stays a little longer than just a second, or less than a second. And then I think we can really notice that things emerge in a with a particular kind of wholesomeness and amazing creativity and unexpectedness. Efficient and beautiful, shocking sometimes. And nothing special at the same time. And I think we can also, again, today take biology as an inspiration about that. So when I did the cosmic walk with the third graders, one of my favorite points on the cosmic walk spiral is the celebration of when there first were eyes, like eyes, to see. Seeing first happened. And I did try to find out, okay, yeah, but what, tell us a little more than just eyes. And I couldn't, you know, I was anyway staying up till 1 o'clock in the morning and to get it finished for the next day, to get the slideshow finished, which of course didn't work. And so one of the kids in the class who was really into the cosmic walk was really into this whole thing, of course, asked, what kind of eyes were they? I have no idea. And I just love life because it isn't just one kind of eye. There was, first of all, just bacteria that started to be sensitive to light, but that didn't count as eyes yet, but already, like, way before eyes. There was sensitivity to light, and there was the revolution of photosynthesis, which is when a cell began to eat light. But then also there were eyes, so these trilobites that are a little bit like cockroaches of the sea. Started to have eyes that were made of calcite rods, so out of mineral sticks that light would come through into the creature. And it's a kind of eye that still is happening, like in lobsters, for example. The calcite rod, the composite eye. Compound eyes, right?
What is it again?
Compound eye. It's called the compound eye. It's just a group of sticks, like rods of calcite, that let the light come directly in.
And then they choose. Are they
tubes? It didn't sound like tubes. I don't know. I haven't seen like a diagram or anything. I just read descriptions of it. And it said rod, which to me means not a tube, except that it can conduct the light in without refracting it. Just. And one evolutionary biologist said that eyes happened. They came about, they came up, they emerged. Just like, why not have eyes, you know? 40 different times. So it's not just like there were eyes and then that spread out everywhere. There were eyes, 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 there were eyes. 40 different times. And some of that passed down. Does that make sense? Is that not cool? And our kind of eyes happened a little bit later, based on water rather than mineral.
You're saying there are 40 different eyes on 40 different species of creatures?
Independently, mm-hmm. like not sharing DNA, mm-hmm. somehow over here arose eyes and passed down to its descendants. Over here arose eyes and passed down to its descendants. Like somehow life got interested in seeing.
Is it all happening kind of at the same time, in the same eras or something?
When we look at this, it's like 500 million years ago. Mm. And then, so like really relatively, it started to happen 500 million years ago. And it wasn't like, well, also, this is all based on the fossils that we find, that we happen to come across. So, who knows?
And now they're growing eyes.
Are they?
To fix blind people, yeah. They're
cool.
Growing the cells of eyes to be able to grow an eye and
one.
Yeah, 41. Right?
41. 41 times.
41st eye.
Well, but we're borrowing from the pattern that already has come about. When there wasn't any pattern, and then there was. And then it's not like our eyes are better than the lobster eyes. Lobster eyes are better at seeing in certain kind of light, like the violet end, violet, ultraviolet end out of the spectrum of light. And our kind of eyes are better at seeing on the red end of the spectrum. So they're both good for different situations.
But and man sees it all, right?
Sorry?
None of the eyes is capable of seeing it all.
Yeah, well, I kind of hope not. I don't know. I hope not. I think already we don't know what to do with all that we can see. And seem to get distracted by all that we can see. And forget to feel and be in touch. So to me, this feels like antidote to when questions come in a small way and we want to know, like, when did the first eye happen? And we assume that's like the king eye and everything else came from there. It just feels so much better that life can come up with eyes so many different places. The impossible can happen again and again. And so even though it's nearly impossible to discover that leg, to discover what's not programming, and to also have the patience to kind of develop and strengthen. Not just to be sensitive to light, but to actually develop and strengthen and refine. So playing with leaving room for what life does, when there's less predictability imposed, what happens? Sticking to the openness more often, and much less often sticking to the obstacles. One Zen master said, there are obstacles to returning to the ancient mountain, but don't delay for that. To me, that speaks to partly the fact that it's hard, but don't delay just because it's hard. In a way, like, get on with it. And also, there's obstacles for returning to the ancient mountain, to that kind of original seat or bigness. But don't delay for that. You don't have to be obstacle-free first. isn't that that one that wants to be able to say, I am at peace, I am enlightened? That wants also to say, I have no obstacles, to have no obstacles. Does anyone have anything to ask or share?
I was thinking about this deciding thing. And maybe it's helpful if we distinguish between a choice and a decision. Mm. Whereas a decision is made by assessing what's going on in thought and getting the data and sorting it out, projecting it into the future and hazarding a guess and then deciding. So you can definitely make a wrong decision because you're speculating. But a choice is something that comes from different partners. You can really, in this interpretation, you can really only make a choice when you're present. When you're present, it comes from a different place. You're flowing along as awareness and a choice point appears. There's nobody there talking about it or commentating. It's just written on the wall of that now. Mm. And you just allow it and it directs you onto a different configuration. You could say that an intention, a choice, or the invention of possibility, these are gifts of presence. Mm. These are things that happen when that thinking, controlling, commentating, criticizing aspect is gone. Mm. And so it's the greatest fun to choose. And it's creative. And it's not any fun at all deciding. You can't make a wrong choice, but you can definitely make a wrong decision. Mm. And they're always right. All the other things about choices, anyway, they're magnificent. And you know, it's such a relief, because there's nobody who likes making decisions because they're really unreliable. Mm.
So just to play with the words, we could almost reverse the words and say the same, but what you're describing is lovely. Like, there's when I'm making a choice or a decision caught up in thinking and thinking that the decision's going to come from the thinking and assuming that what I'm doing is actually coming from the thinking, when what I'm doing is probably not coming only from the thinking but from the programming. And my identification with thinking says I'm thinking this decision, and that is yucky. Unless that's the best we can do and we can accept that, then it's fine. And then what you're calling choice, and I love your love of that, could be, we could equally call it a decision, you know, the words are not important, but that being that present, that as best we can, we let it happen. And even so, I would like to say many times, when the joy and lightness is there that you're describing, great, great sign. But if we construct an idea of being present and letting the choice happen, our programming will sneak in. And I'll be identified with being the free, making the choice, enjoying that, and the programming has done it for me. And so the way you're describing your tone of voice and the love of that gives me that feeling of being placed in the bigger, so to speak, the bigger flow, as you said, not being placed in the smallness or the thinking, and so being placed in the bigger, the fun that you described, that sense of freedom that came across without using the word.
Yeah, because my view is that there's a part of me that is not wounded, that I could never be wounded.
Yes.
That, you know, can't get lost, can't get broken, stained, or anything.
Yeah.
And there's a feeling of being there. And when I move from that, whether it be creating something or making a choice, then it's just completely different.
Yes.
From when I'm, it's a bit like in quantum physics.
Yeah.
That, you know, you go along as a waveform, as a character, as a persona. But as soon as you remember, you break down into a presence.
Yeah.
And that presence is fine.
Yeah.
It's always been fine. Mm. So for me, it's like the only thing to really focus on is that presence, is to keep returning to presence.
Yeah.
Because that's, if there is a healing to happen, it's that. If
yes.
wisdom turns out to be not a new concept that's kind of the culmination of all the ones I've had, and now, ta-da!
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes, I've got it. But wisdom turns out just to be sitting in wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't have to be just, you know, dissolved into something. Mm-hmm. It can just be wisdom. And that, for me, has been the biggest revelation, that there's nothing I've got to, I haven't got to amass nervously some kind of understanding.
Mm.
You know, understanding's worthless.
Mm.
It's fine not to understand. You don't need to understand anything.
Mm.
Because you, somebody's realization can't be my realization. I have to have my realization. Understanding is not the same as realizing. But the mind says, no, you must really understand this, you know, it's very, I'm trying to understand it, it's really important. As soon as you've understood it, you've lost it anyway, you're on to the next thing, isn't it? So it's just to be the wisdom, be, let wisdom be. And see, and when you were saying about, can you take that risk, do you trust it? Well, I hope so, by now. Because every time you do, it's, what's the feeling? In any session of sitting or any week or day, what happens? It's just fantastic every time. The quality of the flow that comes from that, how amazing. The way people are, how amazing. Everything in the nature of awareness, which this is, reflects back, yep, that's the right way. So by now, it's like, oh, can you trust it? Well, yeah, you can trust it. And that ceases to be an issue.
Yeah. Great.
Seems to be a what?
An issue.
Issue.
Something to consider.
Mm-hmm.
So there, I've just brought a few Ikkyu poems to end with. Clouds very high, look, not one word helped them get there. Keep writing those deep questions. Sleep on. When you wake, even you'll be gone. Not two, not one either. And the unpainted breeze. In the painting feels cool. In this poem, I love this. He gives such an ease to receiving the experience of emptiness, of meeting, not two, not one, either. And the unpainted breeze in the painting feels cool. So that importance, not just of what his teacher said to him, or as Tim is also saying, not only important understanding or thinking, but what isn't said, what isn't presented. Not two, not one either. So in the meeting, in the specifics of the meeting, the unpainted breeze in the painting feels cool. I feel like he makes it so easy to get the sense of by leaving room, but being fully in connection, a feeling can come across from what isn't said, from what isn't present. And then another one, last one. He says, you can't be anyone but you. Therefore, you are that other one you love. Okay. You can't be anyone but you. Therefore, you are that other one you love. You are that other one you love. The translator capitalized other, made other, big O. Because I think from inside, we make a big deal about other. And then finding that we're made of all this coming together, not two, not one. What we made a big deal about being other is also here. So doing less and feeling it's almost like hydraulics or a dynamic, doing less and feeling how that gives more to continuity, to sustaining, doing less and finding more of our skin is open to hearing. More willingness to be moved, to be stilled. And also being honest about how often and easily our energy gathers together again in a secretive doing. So whatever we decide we're gonna do, let's be loyal to, or let's gamble on, whatever word you like, emptiness. It's predictable that very soon, within seconds, hours, days, weeks, there will be a version of emptiness that we're trying to do. Mm-hmm. And that's okay. Again, doing less and feeling how the energy falls back into the lap of emptiness, back into sustaining connectivity, connecting flow. And that is in touch with that place that forgives, so that place that isn't hurt, that can pop through. That instead of like trying to get rid of darkness or whatever, invents eyes. Not out of being against darkness, but out of sort of just loving life and May we give ourselves, may we let ourselves be a momentum towards awakening for all, including ourselves.